The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
We came into this election with a real belief on one side or the other, actually, that the election would be rigged in one way or the other. And the issues with mail balloting and the claims of the president since then, the tweeting, et cetera, has all fanned those flames. Now, we may be in a situation where on election night, if the president claims victory, that you are going to see the social media companies flex their muscle in a way that will just provoke some of the acrimony we've seen in the last few weeks. Because they all have policies now to address false claims of victory, even from candidates, where they will either demote it, take it down, or put a filter over these kinds of false claims of victory.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 3rd, that's Election Day, 2020. As I say, it is Election Day, and we have a shockingly good news story for you today on the Lawfare Podcast. Nate Persily of Stanford Law School and Charles Stewart of MIT together run the MIT-Stanford Healthy Elections Project. Zahava Levine and Chelsea Davidson manage the project on the Stanford side, and they have together supervised a collection of students who have produced 32 articles for Lawfare on election administration as part of the project. We got everybody together to discuss how the election is actually going. Are we having a healthy election? What are the rules of mail-in voting? How has litigation actually affected the conduct of the vote? Do we have enough poll workers? And what results can we expect when this evening? It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 3rd. That's Election Day. Are we having a healthy election? Nate, get us started. When we first started talking about these issues, there was a real concern that the states and local jurisdictions were simply going to be unable to actually pull off an election in the circumstances of COVID. It is now Monday afternoon, and 100 million people have already voted. How's it going?
It's going really well, better than expected. If you turn back the clock to the primaries, where we saw polling places being shut down, shortages of poll workers, absentee ballots being thrown out. We are having nothing on the grand scale that we saw in the primary elections in the general. To some extent, we benefited from the fact that the election administrators had the kind of baptism by fire in the primary period. And so you're seeing record turnout, record, of course, absentee ballot turnout, but also we expect between 150 and 160 million ballots to be cast. And so the local election administrators really deserve an enormous amount of credit for all the changes they put in place to avoid the problems that the pandemic was posing.
And my impression is that a lot of people are really quite panicked at this point about the question of whether all of these, 100 million ballots that have been cast are actually going to be counted. And, you see a lot of doom tweeting on this subject, some of it, frankly, fantastical, and some of it, having plausible theories behind it. How confident are you that we're actually going to count the votes that have been cast?
I'm very confident of that. And I have to say, one of the benefits of having all this litigation before the election is that some of the rules have now been clarified. It is true that there will be some states in which, say, late arriving absentee ballots will not count. But that means if they arrive on time, they will count. And so, and almost all of them will arrive on time. And so we've had the rules clarified. The election administrators are already doing the processing, even in places like Michigan. Today, they began processing the absentee ballots, and there have not been significant problems. There is always the possibility of a very close election turning on whether it's absentee or provisional ballots, and then we have a Bush versus Gore style situation. But we are in as good a position as we can be to deal with the glut of absentee ballots that have come in. And so one of the other issues is that there are certain states, and Pennsylvania is one of them, where certain types of challenges had to have already been made. For example, to the eligibility of voters, the deadline was on Friday. And so it's always possible that we could get some surprises in federal court, that there's innovative legal theories that are being tried out in every place from Texas to Minnesota. But looking at the laws on the books and the way that the courts have dealt with them, we're pretty far along in sort of determining what makes for an eligible vote. Most significantly, even today in Texas, we had a judge who was, you know, widely seen as favorable to the Republicans, nevertheless threw out a lawsuit that was seeking to invalidate 127,000 drive-through ballots in Harris County. And so the rules are being made clearer every day. And so there'll be less to litigate after the fact.
Charles, do you have a sense of the picture as quite as sunny as the one that Nate just described? Because, I mean, for a lot of people, there's a real sense of panic now about the sort of election not happening the way it's supposed to. If you had to give this a score relative to your expectations 4 to 6 months ago about where we were going to be on a scale of 1 to 10, what are we looking at in your view?
Yeah, I'm a little trepidatious in responding because I'm always the optimist of the two of us. And so I don't know where to go from what Nate just said. I mean, I have to say that I am optimistic that if I had to state where we are now compared to where I was worried we were going to be in March, I think that we're surprisingly well situated. And I know I'm going to have to eat my hat tomorrow when we discover, you know, someplace that we don't know about quite yet, where, you know, maybe, you know, the counting machines break down, or there's a, you know, a hot spot in a particular county election office or something like that. I mean, but I think that kind of makes the point that I think election administrators have responded to the challenges that they know about pretty well. You know, they've bought the equipment when they've had to buy it. They've arranged to get, you know, large conference rooms and conference facilities for counting of ballots. They've been serious about social distancing. You kind of go down the list. I think, and it illustrates something that Nate and I were, a point that we were making until we were blue in the face back in March and April. And that is, there's a view out there of election administration that it's being run by political hacks for the benefit of political hacks. And when in fact, the actual administration of elections is being done by people who are very rule-bound, who are very detail-oriented, and who, if you give them a set of rules and tell them to go follow those rules, they generally will do it. And then finally, they're also used to dealing with disasters. I mean, one of the things we're not talking about right now, for instance, is, you know, Georgia has been running their early voting during a hurricane. And, you know, nobody's talked about that. Why? Because that's what election officials do. So I've been very pleased with that. I underestimated the degree to which there would continue to be this partisan trench warfare, even onto the eve of the election and presumably moving into election day and beyond. I mean, that's surprised me a bit. But in terms of the election administrators, when the ability to, you know, the recruit poll workers, which was something that we worried about, get the procedures down for dealing with mail ballots, et cetera. You know, they pulled up their socks and they're doing what they need to do.
Ben, if I could just jump in on one thing, just so we're clear. Look, there are going to be lots of problems tomorrow. There are going to be machines that break down. There are going to be polling places that don't open. There are going to be poll workers who don't show up because of COVID or otherwise. There will be rumors of cyber attacks, all kinds of other things, as well as skirmishes at the polls, right? That is going to happen. They will be isolated instances. And the real risk is that we're going to blow those problems out of proportion. No matter what happens tomorrow, there are already 100 million ballots that have been cast and are received. So we are really in the fourth quarter here. We're not at the beginning of the game. And so while there's undoubtedly going to be hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who are frustrated with the way the election is proceeding, it's not going to be, you know, 25% of voters. It's not going to be a large number of the ballots that are implicated. For anybody whose right to vote is affected by these disturbances, it's terrible. But we've been trying to steer a battleship for the last 6 months, and the election officials have basically brought it into port. And the fact that we're going to see a historic turnout, despite the vote suppression, despite the obstacles posed by COVID, is really quite extraordinary.
Well, so you guys set up the Healthy Elections Project. We're having a healthy election. You're done. So, Zahava, you supervised for Lawfare this incredible five-part overview of litigation over mail-in voting. We've just had a flurry of state Supreme Court, federal appeals court, U.S. Supreme Court actions, all related to counting late mail-in votes. So give us an overview of the overview. If you had to sort of summarize the categories of litigations and how they've gone in the mail-in voting department, which is, I think, one of the biggest of the categories that Nate described when he said, you know, the benefits of litigating all this stuff before the election is that the rules are now pretty clear. This is an area where we got, in a messy set of processes, some pretty clear rules. So what happened and how did we get there?
Sure. So I think we got there because of the massive surge in demand for mail voting, which is one of the major themes, as you point out, for this election. With about 80 million Americans expected to vote by mail in November, which is about double what we saw in 2016. Election officials for the last several months have been scrambling to figure out how to adapt the rules of mail voting to meet the surge in demand. And their responses, and sometimes their lack of responses, and sometimes in coordination with the state legislatures, and sometimes without the coordination of the state legislatures, have generated a great deal of debate. And ultimately, the parties have turned to the courts to resolve these disputes. In many, many states, almost all states have had litigation related to mail voting this season. There's been over 200 cases relating to the rules of mail voting, probably a majority of all of the election litigation this season. So what do these cases look like? A majority of the cases, if we go back since March, since the pandemic started, have been cases that are seeking to relax the rules of mail voting and reduce the obstacles, claiming that the obstacles or the rules create an undue burden to voters' right to vote, particularly during the pandemic. So, for example, some states have eligibility requirements to vote by mail. In some states, anybody can vote by mail, but in some states, you need a particular excuse that is specified in state statutes. So there was a whole host of cases that are seeking to allow more people to vote by mail, either by eliminating the need for an excuse altogether in states that require an excuse, or by expanding the list of excuses that qualify. Another whole set of cases is making it easier for voters to submit their ballots. So that might be allowing new ways of dropping off your ballot at a ballot drop box or drive-through voting, or allowing more time for your ballot to arrive into the election office. So we know that there's two, this has been a very hot area of litigation. There's states that require that the ballot be postmarked by election day and received by some period of time after that, usually, 2 to 7 days. And then there's another set of states that require that the ballot be received by election day. So there's a whole set of cases of people that are saying, in light of the pandemic, and particularly also in light of the surge of mail ballot requests and the operational concerns around the United States Post Office, let's relax the rules. And people are seeking to extend the deadline from election day deadlines to postmark by election day. And then the other set of cases that I'll mention here, and there's many more, you can read the 50-page report, are cases that have sought to relax the procedures that are used by election officials to verify that the person who submitted the ballot is in fact the duly registered voter who requested the ballot or the intended voter of the ballot. So the two most common procedures used by election officials for this are election officials require that a witness or a notary sign the ballot and attest that the voter who submitted the ballot is in fact the intended voter. Or another common procedure is called signature verification, where election officials compare the voter signature on the ballot or on the return envelope to a digital image of that voter's signature on file with the election officials to see if they match. And in some states, when these verification requirements are met, or I should say are not met, let's say there's not a witness signature or there's the election officials determine that the signatures do not match. In some states, election officials just disqualify those ballots and they're not counted. And voters sometimes don't even ever know that their vote was not counted. In other states, the rules require that election officials reach out to voters and notify them of the error and give them an opportunity to fix it. And so a big source of litigation this year has been litigants that have seeking to eliminate or relax these verification requirements, either by saying we shouldn't have to have a witness sign the ballot in the time of pandemic, it's a health risk, or if I don't have it, at a minimum, you should let me know and give an opportunity to cure. And it's the same thing with the signature verification. If you determine that my signature doesn't match, the litigants would argue, at least give us notice and an opportunity to cure. And there's been many, many, many of these cases this year. And then I would just say one more thing. Those are some of the cases that have sought to expand the right to vote or make it easier. There's a whole other set of cases that have sought to halt or slow the growth of vote by mail. And those cases generally make two kinds of claims, either that mail voting increases voter fraud and therefore dilutes the votes of legitimate voters, or that the parties that are relaxing these rules, relaxing the rules of mail voting, when it's the Secretary of State or state courts, are not authorized to make those accommodations. And really, it needs to be the state legislatures only that make those accommodations. And those are the two sets of claims on that side. I think the fraud claims have been less successful, but the authority to act claims, the claims that say, the Secretary of State or a state court doesn't have the authority to extend the deadline or to authorize a new kind of vote drop-off center or something like that, those have been a little bit more successful.
So that's a sort of amazing broad overview of the problem or of the litigations over the problem. Nate, you had said earlier that because of this giant barrage of litigation, we actually have a lot of clarity as to what the rules are going to be. Flesh that out a little bit. What are the rules going to be?
Well, so in most states, we now know what the deadlines are going to be and whether ballots that are received on election day or postmarked by election day are going to count. Now, we had a divided Supreme Court decision or non-decision with respect to Pennsylvania that has led them to segregate ballots that are that arrive after Election Day, but that's going to be a smaller number of ballots. But that's just an insurance scheme to make sure that any of those ballots that are potentially in dispute don't affect the ultimate outcome. But I want to emphasize and maybe frame a little bit of Zahava's last point, which is that to some extent, we are seeing the return from the graveyard of certain arguments that were put to bed in Bush versus Gore, and they've really been reinvigorated here. One is this question of what we call the independent state legislature doctrine, whether some actor other than the legislature can enforce, enact, and expand maybe voting rules. That was the issue in North Carolina, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, and even as brought in this recent Texas case on drive-through voting, those arguments were made. And then you're also seeing in Texas and other places some arguments about equal protection. That's the one that I'm actually more worried about, that there'll be arguments on Election Day and in the counting process regarding inconsistent standards being applied through different locales. But this notion of that the state legislature is supreme in enacting and clarifying what the rules are for presidential elections, that's the set of legal claims we need to watch, because it's now clear that there are 5 members of the Supreme Court that take that argument seriously. It has never gotten a majority at the Supreme Court. 3 justices in Bush versus Gore went in that direction. But you are seeing this become part of the kind of argumental orthodoxy in these briefs that are challenging state court judgments that are either interpreting the state constitution or otherwise trying to liberalize balloting requirements for the pandemic.
All right. So one of the things that you guys have been warning about for months has been the relative paucity of poll workers for both early voting purposes, but particularly for Election Day. And I recall, Nate, that you were particularly concerned about whether Pennsylvania and Philadelphia in particular could generate enough poll workers. Chelsea, you have been spending a lot of time on, I'm not sure what to call it, poll worker recruitment or population of poll workers. How are we doing on that?
You know, if you think back to where we were in April, there was deep concern that there was going to be a lack of poll workers throughout the entirety of this pandemic. In Milwaukee in particular, they were running with only 30% of their typical load of poll workers in their early primaries and closed down all but 5 of their 180 polling places as a result. So I think that there was deep concerns at the beginning of this pandemic that we were going to see an incredible lack of poll workers through November. And I think that by and large, that fear should be put to rest. Hundreds of thousands of Americans have answered the call to volunteer to be poll workers. That's due in part to a number of factors. It's because of election administrators getting creative and forging new partnerships, whether that's with local or national businesses or with sporting teams. It's because of a lot of campus recruitment programs stepping up. And it's because of new initiatives that cropped up in the last, 6 to 10 months of groups that are dedicated to recruiting poll workers. Poll Hero is one. Power the Polls is by far the largest. They and their network of state and local partners have recruited hundreds of thousands, over 500,000 at this point, of willing participants to be poll workers. Does that mean that we're completely out of the woods? Of course not. But I think that poll worker recruitment and placement has been something that we've had to look at for a number of years. In 2019, the Election Assistance Commission did a survey of 6,000 jurisdictions, and the vast majority said that they were having difficulty recruiting poll workers at that point in time. So I think that while there will be isolated incidents of maybe poll workers not showing up the day of or needing to deploy emergency poll workers at the state or local level, we're largely out of the woods. Fortunately, election administrators have by and large also chosen to create backup lists of poll workers in case there are last minute day of no shows, which is commendable.
And who gets the credit for this? So, you know, this seems like a genuine mass action. Large numbers of individuals are involved. Presumably people have been recruiting them. I mean, I take it there's no single person or entity that gets the credit for it, but I'm curious how you attribute credit for this relative overperformance relative to expectations.
Well, I do think that credit belongs to every person who signed up, every election official who had the foresight to get on this early, and certainly the organizations that have cropped up. I think, you know, in terms of sheer numbers, it's very, very difficult to overstate the impact that Power of the Polls has had in recruiting hundreds of thousands of people. They also worked very closely with election administrators to ensure that those people who signed up on a website would actually be placed in the places that needed them. So like you mentioned, I think it's very difficult to point it down to one entity because, frankly, it's been a collaborative effort from the start. And I think that we as a country should be very, very proud both of the people who have answered the call and also those in offices around the nation who have made it possible to get these people trained, to get these people placed, to make sure that they're good to go, and to keep all of us safe as we go and vote through the early voting period and tomorrow.
Another lens through which you can see the effects of the decentralization of the political system and the election administration system. I agree with everything Chelsea said. But as you start talking to the diverse array of local election officials, you end up finding things like we did. You know, there are some places where the same person who's the head of elections is also head of licensing of bars. And so they have an email list of bartenders, right? And so they send out the call for poll workers on the email list that they have. And so they ended up saying, look, bartenders, you know, your bars are closed. Come volunteer at the polls, right? Other places they go with the public employees and they can rely on them. Other places they go with the unions. Other places you'll get some student poll workers, you'll get some relationships with the universities. And so you do see a diversity of approaches. And then the Power of the Polls platform, which frankly I was nervous about at the beginning because you just don't know how sometimes these third parties are going to perform and whether they have the relationships with the local election officials that are necessary. But that the fact that they've gotten 500,000 names to then go through the system so that at least in a pinch that the election officials can have a repository of reliable workers does represent a remarkable mobilization.
All right. So let's talk about counting the votes. We've talked about casting them. We've talked about deadlines for receiving them and whether we're going to have enough poll workers to do it. But we've got 100 million votes cast. There are going to be another untold tens of millions cast tomorrow. Charles, we've been getting a lot of warnings. Don't expect the votes to be counted in a normally quick fashion. And as well, disputes over counting votes, we're getting a lot of warnings over. What are you expecting in the vote counting department?
Yeah, well, I am expecting it to go a bit slower overall nationally, but compared to the past. But before jumping into that, I mean, I have to say a couple of things by way of throat clearing. I mean, one is, I think that we meaning Americans have overestimated the degree to which there has been complete vote counting in past elections. That if you just look at, you know, the number of votes that have been accounted for, say, by a midnight on election night or 6 a.m. on the Wednesday morning, you know, we typically have, you know, in a typical fast count night, we still have about 20% of the ballots still to count around the country. Now, some of these are the so-called vote-at-home states, vote-by-mail states like Oregon, Washington, and Colorado that have by policy decided to be leisurely in counting their mail ballots. But it's also been the case in other states that have, you know, not been voted home, but nonetheless have allowed, you know, people to go home and get a good night's sleep before continuing the counting of mail ballots and the rest. And so, you know, that call or that projection, which is actually what I think people are remembering, you know, Americans are not remembering that 100% of the ballots were counted in Illinois on election night 2016 at like 9:30 or whatever time. What they're remembering is that all the networks with a fanfare and a you know, color on the map and all that stuff called a race. And I think a lot of people think that race was called because they had counted all the votes or almost counted all the votes. And that's just not true. So that's just one thing to keep in mind, is that it's always taken a while to count the votes. And so I actually think the other thing to say, and just to underscore what I just said, is that the votes aren't counted until the state election authority, and that's usually some sort of canvassing board, says they've all been counted. And the canvassing of and the final certification of elections around the country, some states, New Hampshire, may very well certify its elections on Friday after the election. California is not going to certify for another month. So there's going to be, and most states are not going to certify for a period of 10 days to 2 weeks. That's the official call of a state, is when a state certifies. Now, practically speaking, there's a lot to be learned from the election returns as they come in. Nate and I have written about this. I would continue to think more about this. And so what we're actually going to discover on election night is that there will be a number of states that actually will get their preliminary count, maybe 90% of their preliminary count, 95% of their preliminary count, out by midnight, 11 o'clock midnight Eastern time on election night. Florida is the state at the top of the list. Florida requires the county officials to report their tabulated early votes and mail votes half an hour after the polls close. And those votes are being counted right now. And they've been counted in Florida for the past 3 weeks. And so there's going to be a big slug of votes that will be delivered at 8 o'clock or so on tomorrow night from Florida. That will be something like 75%, 80% of all the ballots that are going to be counted in Florida will be announced within a few minutes of the polls closing. With that, we're going to get a sense about how close it really is in Florida, but we're also going to get a sense about how much of a shift there has been in the various counties that have completed their count. So if you look in the, you know, if you look in the suburban areas around Orlando, in particular counties like Seminole County, Polk County, Lake County, you know, those are good bellwethers for whether suburban areas around Philadelphia around Milwaukee will be shifting as well. And so we're going to begin to get some presaging of what the night is going to look like when Florida reports its ballots. North Carolina, I think we're going to know very soon what's going on there. There's also going to be some other states that are not battleground states, but we'll get their numbers out fast as well. I'm thinking about Tennessee and Kentucky. And again, we're going to be able to look at those returns, see how much of a national shift, if any, there is in those returns. That shift in those states is likely to be echoed in other states around them. And so we're going to get this picture. So what I've been saying is that, yes, we have been hearing from Pennsylvania that they're unlikely to get their mail ballots counted by Friday. But in many of the other states, the delays that we're likely to see will be a matter of hours. It will not be days. So Wisconsin, for instance, they intermingle their mail ballots and their election day ballots in most of the towns, most of the precincts. Those election workers are not going home until they've counted all those ballots. So we're going to get a big chunk of the count in Wisconsin within hours of those polls closing. Milwaukee is an exception. They count their absentee ballots centrally, but we've been told that they're going to be on top of counting those ballots as soon as they can. And Maybe it won't be midnight, maybe it won't be 3 a.m, but certainly by 6 a.m, we'll know where Milwaukee is. And so we're going to be getting a steady flood of votes on election night. Some of them will look like any other year. And I think Florida, North Carolina, Tennessee may very well be like any other year. We'll have states like Wisconsin or Ohio, where they may be a little longer because of the burden to get the absentee ballots, mail ballots in faster. But that will be a matter of hours rather than weeks. And so I will say that Pennsylvania is a bit of a wild card. I really don't know how quickly Pennsylvania, Philly particularly, can get through all their mail ballots. There's good reason to believe that Philadelphia itself may be a couple of days. But nonetheless, you know, Bucks and Berks counties. I mean, there's a bunch of counties that we can be looking at in Pennsylvania to get a sense of things. So I'm emphasizing people to think in terms of the narrative on Tuesday night. If the polls hold, which is a big if, but if the polls hold, I think we're likely to get what I've been saying is the path to 270. And it will be the type of story that will have kind of a rebuttable prior to the way that the election will end up going.
In other words, not enough to declare victory for one side or another, but enough for one side or another to say with a big smile on their face, things are looking good. We'll talk to you tomorrow or the next day.
Well, I think on that one, I think we absolutely have to call what Donald Trump's strategy is going to be on election night. I think he's going to probably not have a smile on his face, but I think he probably is going to claim that he's won the election or something along those lines, regardless of what that story is. But I do think that the lawyers who are actually interested in winning and making good cases, I think they're going to know where they stand. And it's possible that that Joe Biden can go to sleep at 1 or 2 a.m. and say, I'll talk to you after I've gotten a good night's sleep, but it's looking good for us. We could very well have that. So it's happened before in the past.
Yes, I was going to, that's exactly what I was going to say. I recall in 2004, I believe John Kerry did not concede the night of the election. And I believe the Bush campaign made a statement that was, if John Kerry needs to take the night to reflect on the results of the election, he should take it. I think there was some, I distinctly remember the phrase, reflect on the results of the election. And the next morning he came out and made a concession speech. So Nate, continuing on that theme, this is not an election management problem or an election administration problem. It has social media implications and it's a problem of the larger political system. But if we assume that Charles is correct and the president, irrespective of what the results actually look like, is going to come out and prematurely declare victory, or maybe even worse than prematurely, falsely in the face of evidence that's clearly trending in a different direction, how does a healthy election system respond to that?
Well, one of the things I think we're seeing in this election is that there are debates over the rules, to be sure, but there's also a fight over expectations and perceptions, right? And so, you know, even before the pandemic, we were very much concerned about perceptions of illegitimacy with respect to the vote count. I mean, people may forget that when Donald Trump won the election 4 years ago, he still said that there was fraud. It was one of the rare instances where the winner actually claims fraud, where he said that the popular vote victory of Hillary Clinton was illegitimate because of millions of fraudulent ballots cast. So we came into this election with a real belief on one side or the other, actually, that the election would be rigged in one way or the other. And the issues with mail balloting and the claims of the president since then, the tweeting, et cetera, has all fanned those flames. Now, we may be in a situation where on election night, if the president claims victory, that you are going to see the social media companies flex their muscle in a way that will just provoke some of the acrimony we've seen in the last few weeks, because they all have policies now to address false claims of victory, even from candidates where they will either demote it, take it down, or put a filter over these kinds of false claims of victory. I mean, you know, a claim of victory does not have legal significance, right? It's I could claim victory on election night to be president. It's not going to, you know, have any significance. But what it will do is affect people's expectations. And and how the media then responds to it becomes quite important. Do they put him on television making those claims? I've heard that Vice President Biden is planning a speech no matter what happens on election night. So how he responds will be quite important. And while you're right, which is that the declaration of victory is not itself, it's not legally relevant in terms of who wins, who loses, it does affect, I think, the strategies going forward. And so for those who are concerned about, you know, disorder in the counting process, how different factions perceive the electoral count going, I think will be critical to how they act in that week or so after the election where the absentee ballots are processed and counted. And so one of the things, if you go back to Bush versus Gore in the 2000 election, if you talk to the Bush lawyers, they will tell you that the most important piece of information during the post-election period was the number of votes that appeared in the bottom right corner of the CNN screen, right? Because whoever was seen as being ahead was really seen, you know, seen as the kind of presumptive winner. And so the more that one or the other candidate can be seen as the presumptive winner will then put the opponent in seeming like to be a sore loser, one that's trying to shift the outcome. That's how we could read, say, Jason Miller's comments from the over the weekend, as well as President Trump's most recent proclamations with respect to not counting ballots received after or even counted after election night. So I think that is something that we have to keep our eye on. It could affect people's perceptions, but we all have to be patient and trust the process.
We're going to leave it there. Nate Persily, Zahava Levine, Chelsea Davidson, Charles Stewart, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. And today, I think it is also produced in cooperation with the MIT Stanford Healthy Elections Project, thanks to whom for the incredible content that they have provided on the elections on Lawfare. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our merch is available at the Lawfare store, and you should promote us on Twitter, on Facebook, on whatever social media you use. Our music is performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And for God's sake, if you haven't voted already, just do it. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.